Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in. Hey everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today, I am so excited to introduce our guest for the day, Christopher Calandra. Christopher, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I have been looking forward to our conversation for quite a while. I'm glad it's already here.
Awesome. So everyone, Christopher Calandra is the founder and principal of Elliott Wealth Management Services, which has offices in Connecticut and Florida. Chris is a certified financial planner with over 29 years of experience helping entrepreneurs, retirees, and families achieve their financial goals and objectives. I'm really excited to talk to him about his expertise and what he sees coming down the pipeline from a macroeconomic standpoint. So Christopher, thank you so much for being here. Why don't you start us off with giving us a little bit of your background and what got you interested in being a financial planner in the real estate space in general?
Yes. Before I answer that, I just want to thank you for trying to make me a little younger with the 23 years of experience instead of 29. I am appreciative. So I've been a financial planner my whole career. It's the only thing I have ever done. I started in the field right out of college. And I'm fortunate, Suja, because this is what I always wanted to do. I knew in high school sort of what I wanted to do, definitely through college. And, you know, it's easy to be motivated or appear motivated when you kind of know where you're going. And I always knew that I wanted to deal with money, investments, working, coaching with clients. And so this is my 29th year in the business. In May next year, it'll be 30. And so my practice is built around helping clients win with money, building wealth, making smart financial decisions. And we are probably best described, Suja, as generalists. We have our areas of expertise, but when you're dealing with money and you're dealing with people that all have individual circumstances, we have a lot of experience across a very wide spectrum of topics. And again, our goal is to be a resource to help our clients build wealth and win with money. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So that's awesome. I mean, would you say there was something that kind of inspired you to get in the space of money, basically?
Yeah, I think some of it is just youthful ignorance, I think. And maybe I shouldn't answer the question this way, but I graduated high school in 88, Suja. And the 80s were kind of a time when Wall Street was put on a pedestal. It was kind of heralded. And there was some TV shows, My Family Ties, and the can't think of the actor's name, but he was very interested in the stock market. And you had the movie Wall Street with Michael Douglas. That was a famous movie. There was just kind of this lore of Wall Street. And it was kind of intoxicating because it's a place where you could make money, build wealth, do good things. And so I think some of it was just the age that I grew up in. It kind of attracted me to it. It seemed to have kind of a magnetic effect on me. I don't necessarily believe that's the deepest of roots. Mm-hmm. I think that was the case for me. It just had this allure that was irresistible for me at a young age.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I can relate to that. You know, and something pulls you in and then it becomes something else. It kind of takes on a life of its own, right? Like helping people win with money is such an important service and thing that we all need. We don't get financial educations growing up, et cetera. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I was always very curious about how money worked. Mm-hmm. And I came from, you know, lower middle class. My dad was, you know, corporate America, middle management. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. But I always kind of had an entrepreneurial bent and curious about money. And some of that, I think, Suja, comes from my paper route where you, back in those days, I think I have a few years on you, but you used to deliver the papers. and then have to go house to house and collect the money. So I would collect the money and I'd have all this cash, but yet I'd have to pay the paper on Fridays, but I might collect the money on Monday. And you know what? On Tuesday, if I needed money to go out with my buddies, I might go collecting, see if I could bring in some money. But you needed to make sure you had money to pay the newspaper because it was bad if you didn't. So it was like running a very mini business early on. I learned a lot from that, even though it was very simple. It came to me at a young age. You're talking about 13, 14 years old. And I think that also piqued my curiosity in making money, how money works, and how you could kind of play the game, if you will, so that you could win.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah. I mean, I think having those entrepreneurial experiences when you're a kid can teach you a lot. And if you just keep building on them, that's the key, right? I mean, I can think of some entrepreneurial things that I did when I was a kid, but I did not continue to build on them until later on in life. And anyways,
gotcha.
But still, like, that's just like sort of a side note. In any case, okay. So, you know, I know that you're very passionate about looking at what's going on with the real estate market and with the macroeconomic outlook in general. So I'd really love to jump into that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go for it.
So one of the key themes that we're speaking with clients and I've given a lot of thought to is what's driving the real estate market, the four drivers, as I call it, of the real estate market, because we're in a real estate market that is red hot in most parts of the country. And in some ways, it echoes what we saw before the great financial crisis back in 2005 through 2008. But in many ways, in my mind, it's different. And these drivers, I think, speak to that. So if you don't mind, maybe I could cover a couple.
Yeah, let's go for it.
So I think the first couple, I think probably your listeners, and your show is great, by the way, will kind of appreciate already. We're in a low interest rate environment. Interest rates are near zero. So borrowing money is very inexpensive now. And the Federal Reserve, at least up until recently, had said that they were not going to change rates until 2023. Very recently, they've moved that up where they're expecting maybe in late 2022. But even when the Federal Reserve begins raising rates, whether it's late 2022 or 23, rates are still going to be low for quite a while. And low rates are something real estate investors, real estate buyers used to drive real estate investing. You could buy a bigger property because you have a smaller payment. It becomes more affordable. And this is helping drive prices higher. This has been in place for a while. You've been in the real estate space for a number of years. Interest rates have been low for a while. So this isn't exactly new. However, we did see a leg down after the pandemic where interest rates got even lower than they were before. And these low rates are helping drive real estate values higher. So that's the first one I'll throw out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I remember I bought a property in 2018 and it was at like, you know, 4.6% or something. And now people are I mean, you know, obviously it's been a little bit up and down, but currently down. Can you just, for our listeners who aren't really familiar with the Fed and why they increase and decrease interest rates, would you mind? I mean, I appreciate, you know, the specific comments on how it relates to multifamily and real estate pricing in general, but could you just back up and explain why the Fed would increase and decrease rates?
Yes. So this is going to be the classic definition, like you would learn from your economics textbook. It's become a little distorted and a little bit more complex in today's activities by the Federal Reserve. But here's the basic rationale. When they want to spur economic activity and they want to get more money into the system, they will lower rates. Because when you lower rates, it should stimulate borrowing and economic activity. And when that activity is stimulated, money goes from the banks into the public domain so that consumers, real estate investors, home buyers, business owners that are looking for property for their businesses, they will have more money available to them at more attractive prices. And that activity will stimulate growth. So the goal when they lower interest rates is to stimulate growth by essentially making it easier, greasing the skids, if you will, getting money into the marketplace, into the hands of business people and homeowners so that they could buy property. Make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not just buying property too. It's also just lending in general. If you wanted to expand your business and borrow for expansion, or you wanted to borrow for a car, it's not just real estate. It's any lending would be spurred on by lower interest rates.
Absolutely. Therefore driving the economy. And can you now speak to when the economy slows down, or if the Fed is, you know, worried that the economy is going to slow down, they'll lower rates, and that drives people to make more purchases. And, you know, I know where this is going, but can you just lay out for us, like, what is the potential negative consequences of lowering interest rates?
Yes. And this is, I think, very timely today, Suja, because with the pandemic last year and the economic dislocation that caused, it made sense that the Fed went to the playbook and lowered rates even lower than they were before to try and make it easier for people to borrow money to spur economic growth. The danger in where we are today, as I see it, is that we've been lowering rates since the early 1980s. So this has been a 40-year cycle. If you're at home and you want to Google and look at interest rates starting from 1980 to now, you're going to see a very distinct trend line of interest rates going down from, you know, highs of 16, 17, 18%, whatever it was, and consistently coming down over time. You'll see a few, you know, bumps up along the way, but it's a very definitive trend line down. The Federal Reserve has been very accommodative in lowering interest rates consistently over time. And that's probably helped the U.S. economy, because it's been a good 40-year period for the U.S. economy, generally speaking. It's not perfect, but generally speaking. But now here's the danger. We're almost at zero. Where do you go? Where do you go from here? We kind of took all the tools out of the toolbox, perhaps. And if we had another crisis, if we had another downturn, the traditional playbook of lowering interest rates using that tool is either not going to be available, or it's less effective. It's more effective when you go from 8 to 7 as it is when you go to 50 basis points to 25 basis points. It just is not that impactful. So it seems like we've kind of rode out the trend, if you will. And what will happen if we need to lower interest rates again? Do we go negative interest rates, which has never happened in a developed country's economy before? That has crazy ramifications. So it's really an interesting episode we find ourselves in, where you're almost near zero. You start to think that interest rates have to go up over time, and they probably will. And the other danger is that if you get economic growth that's unchecked, that might sound good at first, and there are positives with that. However, it could lead to inflation, runaway inflation, inflation that's out of control, and that could be very problematic. And you're starting to see inflation in the system in the United States over this last couple of months, really strong inflation. And that's one of the worries that we're tracking at my practice, Elliott Wealth Management, as we're trying to help our clients, because inflation could become a key negative that needs to be dealt with. We're not there yet, but it's something closely being monitored by my team and I.
For sure. Yes. And I'm curious, you know, where are you seeing those signs of inflation over the last couple months?
Well, I think listeners could attest to this. If you go grocery shopping and you see the price of food, it's gone up noticeably, not just over the last year, but especially in the last couple of months. Gas prices are up 40, 50% just since the beginning of this year. Those are two examples. Mm-hmm. Used cars, we see some weird stuff in the economy, Suja, today. Used cars are up like 40%. There's lots of instances where you might have bought a car 3 years ago and you could sell it now for more than you paid for it. Mm-hmm. That's wild. You never saw that before. Used car prices are up like 40%. Mm-hmm. There's inflation in real estate. We've seen over this last year plus, real estate prices go up dramatically. That's another example of inflation. It costs you a lot more to find a home now than it did a year ago. That plays into inflation. And when the government has recently reported numbers, Suja, where we compare, say, the month of August 2021 versus August 2020. We're seeing inflation numbers as reported by the government that are 7, 8, 9%, sometimes higher. And you have to go back to the early 80s to find the last time in US history where we had comparable inflation numbers. Now, to be clear, it's only been a couple of months, and the Biden administration and the Federal Reserve chairperson is Jay Powell. They have stated on the record numerous times that they believe that this inflation is transitory, which is just a fancy word for short-term, temporary. I think the jury is still out. And when we talk a little bit more about the drivers of the real estate, one of them will help explain some of why I think the jury is still out. A lot of consumers, there's been some polling on this. Americans seem to think that inflation is going to be with us for longer than the government is saying. And that could be a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, if enough people think something's going to happen, they may actually bring about that outcome just by changing their behavior in the marketplace. So I think it's a really big topic that's only going to get bigger, this inflation story.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. I want to move to the second one, but just for some context. So the Fed, when they increase, if they want to prevent inflation, they may consider bringing rates back up, right?
Correct. So what you want to do is not have the economy be a runaway train. Mm-hmm. And so when you raise interest rates, you're doing the opposite of what I spoke about before. You're trying to make it a little more difficult for individuals to borrow money, meaning that they're going to be more careful about buying and be more deliberate to try and cool the economy a little bit. When you get inflation, inflation is defined as too much money chasing too few goods. Mm-hmm. So when you lower interest rates, you're putting money out there. Well, if you put too much out there, you could have too much demand relative to supply. Mm-hmm. And then you'll get prices going up. If you get too much of that, it's too out of control. People will stop doing stuff and change their behavior. And you don't want that. It's a little bit of like the Goldilocks. You want growth. You want a little inflation, but you don't want it to get too out of hand where it starts to distort decision-making by business owners, homeowners, investors, and consumers. So that's why the Federal Reserve likely changed their forecast from raising interest rates in 2023 to maybe starting in 2022, acknowledging that this inflation thing is only been a couple of months, but noteworthy nonetheless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So you touched on something which I think is going to help lead us into another one of the drivers, which is, you know, the money supply. And so lowering interest rates on one hand can spur growth and increase pricing potentially. And then simultaneously, while interest rates are going down, we've also been, you know, injecting a lot of money into the United States economy. Can you speak to that?
Yes. Yeah. Injecting money into the economy doesn't do it justice. Standard operating procedure, the federal government, in conjunction with the Federal Reserve, when there's a crisis, the playbook says you want to put money in the system, get money out on the street. And when we had the pandemic, that is exactly what the government did. The thing about it, though, Suja, is that it was unprecedented amounts of money that they pumped out into the U.S. economy. How much?
Yep.
If you have $3 in your wallet or purse, and hopefully you have more, but if you have $3, one of those $3 was created in the last 15 months, probably.
That's crazy.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
And if you think about it in terms of real estate, you maybe, like most people, see some of the activity in the real estate market and say, well, it seems like this prices are crazy. The market's crazy. Mm-hmm. It is. But part of the reason it is because people have so much money. Now, I know there are some people that have struggled through the pandemic, you know, maybe had their business close, or maybe their income was down, maybe they lost their job. But those people are fewer and farther between compared to people that have come out of this very well, mm-hmm. and are doing well financially, income-wise. Their investments probably went up. Their home is worth more. They might have gotten unemployment, the extra unemployment money. They might have gotten PPP from the government. They might have gotten the stimulus checks, whatever. So it's not just that people want to buy houses, because people always want to buy houses, right? It's also because there's so much more money out there that people now can deploy that money. If one out of every $3 is newly minted, it demonstrates how much money has been injected mm-hmm. into the system. It's yeah. unprecedented. It dwarfs what the US's reaction was to the great financial crisis back in 2008, 2009. Mm-hmm. But it also plays into the inflation story. If inflation is too much money chasing too few goods, well, now you have all this extra money out there. Have we increased the supply of real estate? Not really, but you have a lot of money chasing it.
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, L-U-X-E-cap.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
Yeah. I mean, the numbers that you put out there are kind of crazy, because it's like, that means if you had $2 before the economy, then the US government added $1 to your purse. And that is like a 50% increase in the money supply.
Yes.
Which is, Do you know, I mean, off the top of your head, do you know what that similar sort of scenario would look like in 2008?
I don't know the numbers off the top of my head. I don't recall the research, but I know that this is, you know, you're talking about 2, 3, 4, 5 times. I don't remember exactly, but it dwarfs what was done in response to the Great Recession. And, you know, now it's worked so far, right? Because the U.S. economy is growing strongly now, and U.S. corporate earnings, publicly traded companies are putting out very good earnings. So you can make a very good case that this has worked, but there could be unintended consequences mm-hmm. of all this money sloshing around in the economy. And part of it is inflation, and part of it is why you're seeing housing prices go up so much, why you're seeing food prices go up so much. It's all kind of related. Now, the thing is, in the lead up to the Great Recession, when real estate went sky high and led to the crash or the Great Recession, you didn't have this money supply factor pre-financial crisis. So that makes this real estate market significantly different than lending standards. And you probably know this given your work with real estate syndications. Is if you go borrow money from a bank for a real estate project, the rules are still pretty stringent. The bank just doesn't give money away like they did back in 2007. There's still very good lending standards. And the excesses of the great financial crisis, the foundations of that crisis, was in large part because lending standards got so loose that you could get money on just about any deal. You didn't have to tell income. You didn't have to tell assets. You could inflate property values. It was kind of a crazy lending environment. You don't see that today. And a lot of, and think about this, if you know people that have bought a home lately, forget real estate investing. If you know anybody that's bought a home lately, to the extent you know about their finances, are people buying these homes with no money down, 3% down, 5% down? Well, by and large, are you observing that people are putting big chunks of money down?
By and large, people are putting money down.
Big chunks.
Yeah, big chunks.
A lot of people are buying homes for cash, mm-hmm. especially people in big urban areas that are looking for property in Arizona, Florida, North Carolina, that kind of thing. I think half of the homes in the U.S. now have either that have 25% or less debt on the property. So people are pretty well financed with their real estate. Now, you could find commercial properties, you know, that it's different. I'm talking in generalities, but this money supply is a big reason why real estate market has gone up. People have money.
Yeah.
Are they going to put it in a 0% bank account, or are they going to try and get a better rate of return? Often they're going to try and get a better rate of return. Real estate has done well for a very long time now, and some of that money is making its way into the real estate market, helping to drive prices higher.
Yeah. I think you explained that really well.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, for sure. I think
that's what I'm here for.
Yeah, totally. Okay. So number three, should we go on?
Yeah, let's do number three. And this probably has some awareness for your listeners, but it's the stay-at-home economy. People have now a new appreciation of their homes, having spent probably more time in them last year. So people have chosen to beautify their homes in many instances, build a nicer home office, have a nicer deck, redo the kitchen. People have chosen to reinvest money into their homes and their properties, and that's helped drive prices higher. And some of that is a function of the stay-at-home economy. Mm-hmm. Also, we've seen a spike in vacation homes mm-hmm. where people are saying, well, if I'm going to be home and I can't necessarily go cruising or go vacation, I might as well have a second home. So vacation home demand has increased quite a bit. That's also a function in large part of the stay-at-home economy. And so our view on work being done from the home as opposed to the office, this was already a trend that was in place before the pandemic, but it is greatly accelerated into and through the pandemic.
Greatly.
And if you're going to work from home, you want to have a nice home. You may even want to have a second one, or you want to have a bigger one, or you don't want to be in a one-bedroom apartment with your spouse or significant other. If both of you are working from home, you simply want or need more space. And all of this has led to an increase in prices. And that's the third driver of the real estate market, the impact of the stay-at-home economy.
Because people are investing more in their home, so they're more expensive now.
Yes.
And people want more out of their home.
Correct.
Yeah.
Think about people that you know. Again, we're not talking about real estate investors specifically, but think about people you know that own homes. I bet you a big percentage of them have invested in their house in the last 12 months.
100%.
Bathrooms, decks, improve their home, office, new windows, new floor, whatever. It's just a ton of that going on. And it's actually turning out to be a good investment because they're being rewarded with not only having a nicer house, but seeing it pay off when they look at Zillow and they see their Zestimate that the home went up in value.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Decisions getting reinforced because it seems like it's profitable.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. The stay-at-home economy as a driver of real estate prices, for sure. Awesome. Well, how about the last driver of real estate prices?
Yeah, the last driver, I think, unlike some of the others I've mentioned, this may at first glance not be thought of, but we have a limited housing supply. Now, I know that a lot of people are saying, well, yeah, the prices are going up because there's a supply-demand imbalance. There's too many people that want to buy and too few people that want to sell. That's true. But this is something that's built up quite a bit over the last decade. We do have a lot of demand and we don't have enough supply, but this lack of supply has been building up for a long time. I read some great research from a company called First Trust. They're an investment company, and their chief investment officer is a guy named Brian Westbury, big fan of his. And some of the research I read from him, and I confirmed it in other places as well, is that the US needs to build about 1.5 million homes a year to keep pace with population growth and homes that leave the market. They get destroyed in a tornado or flood. They become obsolete. They need to be torn down. You need about 1.5 million homes. But we've only been doing 1.25 million a year. We haven't hit the 1.5 million mark since 2006. So it's my belief mm-hmm. that's what's driving the market is not just this temporary supply demand imbalance.
Just real quick, is that speaking to multifamily as well, like multifamily units
yes.
as well, or is it single family?
Yes, both. Any housing, but it wouldn't include like office space, retail space, industrial. Yeah. There's been a shortage. And so with the pandemic, with all these other factors, we have this confluence of events that all of a sudden has revealed the shortage being important all at once. All these factors kind of coming into play. And so you see this rapid increase in prices because it's almost like a garden hose that the water was kind of trickling through. There was a little blockage that was building up, but then all of a sudden it got shut off. It doesn't take long for it to have a very noticeable impact. And I believe that's part of what is going on. You mentioned multifamily housing. There hasn't been that much of created since the Great Recession, just not enough to accommodate the needs mm-hmm. of the economy. And so now you have this increase in demand backed by these other drivers, but you've had supply that's been kind of behind the curve for a while. Now it's really behind the curve. And you can't just go out and build new houses. It's not as easy as creating other goods and services in the economy. And an additional complication, Suja, is with the prices increasing, supplies, raw materials, siding, 2x4, timber, copper, those prices are high. When you're building a home, it might be great to say, hey, I'm going to build a home because I know there's people out there will buy the home and I can make a few bucks. But it's a little challenging because your cost of goods has gone sky high during the same period of time. So it's a tricky proposition. But I think one of the drivers is the limited housing supply. And it's not just a short-term thing. It's been building up a while. And I'll also add, I mentioned before, the vacation homes. In a lot of instances, people are buying homes, but not selling one. So normally, if I own a starter home and then I want to buy a second home, I sell my starter home, I get in the second home. So really, I didn't create any supply-demand imbalance. But you're seeing a lot of people buying second homes for a lot of reasons related to the pandemic. And so if you have somebody that lives in a co-op in New York City and they buy a home in Florida, well, then they bought that home in Florida, but they don't have a corresponding sell. So they actually constrict the housing supply even more. And you see this in a lot of markets. And it also helps explain why real estate prices are going higher. You have a lot of buyers out there that are not also sellers.
Yeah. Interesting. Makes a lot of sense. I hadn't really thought about the vacation home rental market in that from that angle. So here's a question, just thinking back to 2005 and 2006, when we were overbuilding, was that something that, I mean, I was a little like younger back then and not necessarily paying to macroeconomics and housing supply. So did we know back then that we were overbuilding?
You know, some people did, yes. But generally, the thinking was that the U.S. real estate market had never had a downturn. And if it never had a downturn, why would it? And it just got on this momentum play where it was a good investment. People wanted to do more. And the banks, backed by government policy, again, lots of different factors here. Not one is the sole culprit. But you had bad government policy followed by bad behavior up and down the chain. Banks behave badly, consumers behave badly, appraisers behave badly. It was just a mess. But the underlying thinking was real estate never goes down. It's a good investment. And that kind of was jarring what we saw, because it was really the first time in U.S. history where prices went down, especially noticeably. But one of the factors in that was that lending standards got so loose that money was being lent to people that they shouldn't have lent money to, on deals they shouldn't have lent money to, on terms that they shouldn't have lent money to. And that was a three-pronged recipe for a mess. That's exactly what we got.
Yes. And we don't have those kinds of that particular issue currently. Right?
I think this run-up, the drivers of this run-up are different than the last run-up. Now, we may end up in the same place. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. But the underlying foundation is different. And I think of these four factors when you think of them, I don't think any of them are likely to go away soon, right? Interest rates may change in a year, but you're still going to have historically low rates. The stay-at-home economy, will people go back to work as the pandemic subsides? Will they go back to the office? Probably. But are we going to go back to where we were before the pandemic? I don't think so. I don't think anybody.
Well, one question that I kind of think about is, you know, obviously most people are doing better, but there are certain things that are going to be running out, like mortgage, you know, forbearance is going to, there's like the Biden administration has indicated that they're not going to be extending forbearance. And so if rates start increasing, then presumably house prices would go down. There would be downward pressure on house prices. And so if, depending on how high the government needs to raise, the Fed needs to raise rates, then if housing, I wonder if people are going to be underwater again because of that factor.
my forecast, and listen, this is my opinion. I would not suggest any listeners go out and act solely on what I'm about to say.
Sure.
That would be foolish. I think that the explosiveness in real estate prices will subside because we will get supply-demand balance back in more normal range before too long. But I don't think prices are going to go down. Now, this is in general. There might be some markets, some locations, you know, a big employer may move and you could have disruptions locally. But generally speaking, I think that these prices that have increased, I think they will stick. And I don't think that there'll be enough new supply with forbearance and foreclosures. They'll go up a little bit. But I don't think it'll be enough where you create a big buying opportunity. I think that these prices will hold. The growth in prices will normalize. That's my projection. I would take the other side of the debate of someone who thinks that I'm not going to do anything now because I think my prices are going to come down and I'm going to be able to scoop up and get really good values. That would not be my forecast.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then I think that makes sense. And I think that's, you know, especially given the constrained supply. And that brings up another question that I, you know, want to pose to you, which is, so we've been building fairly expensive housing, I would say. Like, it's been expensive to build housing. And it's, I mean, with obviously lumber prices are fluctuating, materials prices are fluctuating, but there's a general upward pressure on them at this time. And yeah, to me, it seems like it's just, it's too expensive to build housing the way we're building it. What are your thoughts on that?
Yes, the raw cost of building has gone up quite a bit. In a lot of locations, it's expensive because of government dictates. I'm not saying that's good or bad, but the dictates only get more severe. They never get less severe.
Yeah, for sure. I haven't seen them get less severe.
Yeah, and that adds to the cost. And many urban areas, you know, there's so many restrictions, it's almost prohibitive to put new supply online. And New York City with rent control is an example of this. And California has some of the most restrictive zoning regulations in the country. So it's not going to be so easy to bring a lot of supply on for all of these factors. If you're a builder and you see this great demand, you may say, well, I'm going to put up houses, you know, because I have demand. But then when you look at your supply chain, the cost increases and the chance you may even not be able to get what you need when you need it in time to have a smooth process, because supply chains are stretched in many, many areas in the country, you know, it starts to be a little bit more of a risky endeavor. If you're going to put up a house and you say, I need this and this day, and you have 2-3-4 week delay, it becomes a big problem to your profits. You know, as an example, if you go today and want to buy, say, furniture, there's a good chance you're going to wait months to get that furniture delivered. So if you're going to build a house, you know, the idea is you got to build it in, you know, time is money and you want to build it quickly. And that becomes a little tricky when you have these not just supply chain price increases, but also just delays in getting goods at any prices in time. It becomes challenging. This will all work its way through the system, but it's going to take a little bit. And it's why I think that real estate won't necessarily be as explosive as it's been, but I think it's still going to be okay and still has room to go because these drivers, I think, will be with us for a little longer.
For sure. Yeah. Awesome. Well, that was a lot of great information, Christopher, on, you know, just, I appreciate your outlook on where we are from a housing pricing and macroeconomic standpoint. Thanks so much for coming on and sharing your expertise. I would love to give you the opportunity to please share with the listeners how they can learn more about you and anything else you want to share.
Yeah. So we're in growth mode. My practice, LE Wealth Management Services, we would like to add new clients where we do financial planning, helping them achieve their financial goals quicker by working in partnership with us. So you could check out our website and sign up for a complimentary consultation. I would love to talk to your listeners about their individual circumstances and see how we might be able to work together and help them achieve their financial goals. The website's elliottwealth.com. Elliot has two L's and two T's. And I'll also add that I have a podcast, Simply Financial, Chris Calandra, Simply Financial. and it's on all the major platforms for podcasts. And you could check that out if you want to hear me shoot my mouth off some more.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, I hope you all take some time to check out Christopher and his podcast. I certainly will be doing that. Christopher, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing so much valuable insights and information with us. I know we could talk for hours more about all of this, but this has been a great overview. So thank you so much. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you. We'll see you soon.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.